KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Debbie Elliott. This hour, did the White House sign off on Israel's plan to strike Iran? And what does the conflict mean for talks on Iran's nuclear program? Plus, a shift in policy has immigrants asking, who's welcome in the U.S.?
It feels like I'm doing wrong. You know, I'm not American enough, right?
Later in the show, a Top Chef contender introduces us to Chinese barbecue with a low country flair.
Chinese food has 500 years of history. I've explored very little of it. So I want to just focus on what we do now and just make it better every day.
We'll get a taste. First news, it's Saturday, June 14th, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. A rare military parade will be held in Washington, D.C. tonight to celebrate the U.S. Army's 250th anniversary. But as NPR's Frank Langfitt reports, some are criticizing the event as reminiscent of similar displays in China and Russia.
Lyle Goldstein is a military analyst with Defense Priorities, a Washington think tank. He says the Army deserves a big birthday bash, but he'd prefer it was more historical and less political.
If I were to plan this, I would like the Army to parade through Concord and Lexington and maybe down to Bunker Hill, right, where some of these historic events were. Rather than through Washington, D.C., which does have some kind of echo of these parades in many authoritarian countries.
To that point, protests against Trump are scheduled across the country today. The protests are called No Kings. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
Those protests today followed demonstrations in response to federal immigration raids. In Chicago, reporter Sarah Karp of member station WBEZ has more.
There's been rallies ramping up ever since the clashes began in Los Angeles and the National Guard was called in. But even before that, there was a lot of angst in the city as immigration agents showed up at court hearings and at regular immigration check-ins. Tuesday night was the biggest demonstration this week, drawing more than 1,000 people.
And several cities' elected officials are calling on citizens to protest peacefully or risk consequences for violence, destruction, and disruptive actions like blocking roadways. Expats overseas are also demonstrating against the military parade through Washington. A couple of hundred showed up in Restorers Square in Lisbon, Portugal.
Fascism, not in America. Fascism, not in America.
Similar expat protests are being held across Europe, including those in England, Ireland, Scotland, France, Belgium, Germany, Italy, Greece, and Denmark. The Israeli military continues strikes on Iran following overnight explosions at Tehran's airport. Iranian media say there have been also more attacks on the city of Tabriz. Yesterday, Israeli planes struck Iranian nuclear and military sites. Iranian state media say 60 civilians were also killed in an Israeli airstrike. The BBC's Sebastian Usher has more.
The air defense system, I think, is an attempt to clear a path to the Iranian capital to essentially make it so that the Israeli Air Force will be able to strike at will. We've also heard from the Iranians that two more senior commanders have been killed. The Israeli military has said that they have assassinated 9 senior Iranian nuclear scientists. That's 3 more than we were hearing about yesterday. They say they've attacked more than 150 targets in Iran since this campaign began.
The BBC's Sebastian Usher in Jerusalem. This is NPR. In 2 shootings in Minnesota, officials now say State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband have been fatally shot in what's described as a politically motivated shooting. State Senator John Hoffman and his wife were also shot. They have survived. Israel's attack on Iran sparked a sell-off in the stock market at week's end. NPR's Scott Horsley reports all the major market indexes closed in the red.
Crude oil prices jumped and stock prices tumbled after Israel launched airstrikes on Iran's nuclear facilities. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 770 points on Friday. Stock in the Dow component Boeing also fell this week after the deadly crash of a 787 Dreamliner in India. There was some good news for investors. Inflation was relatively tame last month, as falling gasoline prices helped keep the overall cost of living in check. So far, the inflation numbers show little sign that President Trump's tariffs are pushing prices up, although forecasters say that could change. For the week, the S&P 500 index fell 0.4%, the NASDAQ fell 0.6%, and the Dow dropped 1.3%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
A federal appeals court voted 8-2 not to reconsider its ruling to uphold a $5 million civil judgment against Donald Trump in the case of advice columnist E. Jean Carroll. A jury had found in a 2023 trial that in 1996, in what started out as a friendly department store encounter, Trump had sexually abused the writer. Trump's lawyers had petitioned the full appellate court to rehear the case. In the Friday decision, the panel said that would not be appropriate. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Debbie Elliott, sitting in for Scott Simon. Good morning, and thanks for being with us today. Israel and Iran traded military strikes overnight as tensions escalate between the two countries. Israel struck first on Friday local time, targeting a range of military and nuclear sites inside Iran, killing several top security chiefs. Iranian state media report that subsequent strikes hit residential buildings in the capital city of Tehran. A barrage of Iranian ballistic missiles targeted Israeli cities overnight, including Tel Aviv, striking several sites there. Israel's defense minister warned that unless the missile attacks stop, then, quote, Tehran will burn. Aaron David Miller is a former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator. He is now senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and is with us this morning. Good morning.
Morning, Debbie. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what you make of the developments overnight.
I mean, I think it's the headlines, Debbie, are going to be the trend lines for the foreseeable future. The Israelis have established escalation dominance in the air. They spent 2 hours this morning striking targets in and around Tehran, and I suspect those strikes are going to continue both against Iran's conventional sites, its ballistic missiles, its UAVs, its drones, and its ballistic missile production facilities. And even though after a day and a half, the Israeli attacks on the nuclear sites seem to not been the key priority, I think it's going to assume a greater importance in the days ahead.
So let's talk a little bit about Iran's nuclear facilities. What does this conflict mean for the country's nuclear program?
You know, the Iranians have invested over time $5 trillion in this nuclear program, and they've chosen to remain a screwdriver's turn away from a nuclear weapon. It gives them regional reach. It gives them resonance. It makes them central to the conversation, the reality of the Middle East. They've chosen not to weaponize, but as they've enriched uranium, as their advanced centrifuges continue to spin, as the stockpile of highly enriched uranium grows, the danger of entering what one Israeli described as a zone of immunity, in which no matter what the Israelis would do, Iran's capacity to weaponize relatively quickly, let's say within a year, to actually produce a weapon, they need a physics package, they need to miniaturize the warhead, they need to deliver it. It's become a program of national prestige, and perhaps now that the Israelis have tried to eliminate it, it's going to be very hard, it may actually incentivize, assuming the regime, assuming it's stable and continues to survive, to actually go for a nuclear weapon. So there's no good solution to this, with the exception, and I'm not recommending this, I wish it would happen, but I think it's very hard to do, a new Iranian regime that is less acquisitive and doesn't want or need a nuclear weapon. And that to me is a long way away.
Now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that the military operation will last as long as it takes. He's also calling on Iranians to rise up against their regime. What is Israel's endgame here?
This is a really good question. You know, 18 months on after October 7th, the Prime Minister wants total victory in Gaza. So I'd argue to you that a controlled level of escalation conflict is good for his politics. But what does he want in Iran? Total victory would mean the decimation and the eradication of Iran's nuclear program. Israeli military capacity, however extraordinary it's been, and it's demonstrated that over the last year against Hezbollah and against Iran, it doesn't have what is required to essentially try to eradicate the program. Israelis may also want regime change. I think the Prime Minister's statement is encouraging Iranians to rise up. It's part of that strategy. Hard mm-hmm. to do, though. Very hard to do.
Do you have a sense of how President Trump wants this to play out?
Fascinating question. I mean, and the debate's going to continue until some adventurous journalist puts together a TikTok about what he actually said to Netanyahu. Did he try to dissuade him? Green light, red light, flashing yellow light. He didn't say no. So clearly, he wasn't prepared to stand in the way of what the Israelis wanted to do. And I think he cooperated in the ruse that the Israelis created in order to fool the Iranians into thinking that the strike would not occur until after this negotiating session in Oman, which is supposed to meet, probably won't, on Sunday. So I think he's riding the tiger now. I think he sees a real advantage. His MAGA base may not like it. He doesn't want to get drawn, doesn't want the U.S. to get drawn into a major war, but he sees some advantages right now in supporting the prime minister.
That's Aaron David Miller from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Debbie.
Now, for more, we turn to NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Debbie.
So what do you make of the Trump administration? You know, the White House said the U.S. wasn't involved in the Israeli attacks, but did it sign off on the strikes in some way?
Yeah, we don't know that yet. Both Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu have said that the White House was given a heads up, but we don't know the full picture here. There's always, you know, a lot of spin going after these kinds of events. Trump told ABC News that the attacks were excellent, quote, and that there's more to come. He said they gave Iran a, quote, chance and they didn't take it. He told the New York Post that he, quote, always knew the date for the strikes. Now, we don't know here if the Trump administration is playing good cop, bad cop with Iran and trying to still maintain some leverage for a nuclear deal. We don't know if the White House wanted Israel to hold off, but it's hard to see how this makes it easier for Trump to get an Iran deal, nuclear deal done, because Iran now says talks with the U.S. are meaningless. And Trump was on social media yesterday on his platform trying to use the strikes as leverage, saying that there's still time to prevent the, quote, next already planned attacks from happening.
Now, what about the politics? As Mr. Miller just mentioned, a lot of Trump's MAGA base is against getting involved in any military conflict with Iran. Is there a split here on the right?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a split on the right when it comes to foreign policy since Trump came on the scene. I mean, the glue that's really held the Republican Party together has been culture war issues, you know, whether it's hard lines on immigration, blocking trans rights, not really international affairs. They've ranked low, not just among Republicans, but in voters' concerns generally. But there's been a split for sure within Republicans on how to handle it. You know, Trump doesn't really have a clear ideology on foreign policy other than being transactional. We certainly saw that on his trip to the Middle East, for example, where he was less focused on spreading American ideals than making financial deals. I'm not sure, though, how much of this is going to affect him really with his base. You know, for some on the right in the MAGA base, they don't want any involvement globally. They'd be unhappy, for example, with more funding to Ukraine. But this is their guy, and they're not going to abandon him. And some are sounding off, hoping to influence policy, but he's going to do what he wants.
Another big story this week, the conflict over immigration raids and Trump's deployment of the National Guard to Los Angeles. What's next in California's lawsuit over that?
We know there's a hearing on Tuesday to see whether or not the National Guard will be returned to Gavin Newsom's control, the governor of California. So we'll see how that winds up. There was a ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that put a stay on a lower court ruling that had granted that power back to California. So this is another example of the lower courts intervening, being somewhat of a check on Trump. But overall, I think that this immigration issue has actually started to move Democrats out of this slumber that we'd seen in the first few months of the Trump administration, them not knowing how to attack Trump, what message to use, the harshness of some of his deportation policies of going after day laborers and cooks and farm workers certainly seems to be a bridge too far, even for some within Trump's own party. You know, polling's
been kind
of
all over
the place.
Yeah, and the president has indicated he's going to reverse himself on that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that that is an indication of where the politics of all of this is.
And today is President Trump's 79th birthday. It's also the day of his military parade in D.C. and protests around the country. Why is this celebration so controversial?
Well, it's not something we've seen really in the United States for decades, where we're celebrating big military marches down main avenues in the Capitol with tanks and weapons, all for, you know, all for show, really. It's not something that the U.S. does. Of course, people on the left already see Trump moving with autocratic tendencies, look a lot like something out of North Korea or Russia. Of course, this is ostensibly for the U.S. Army's 250th birthday. It happens to be on Trump's birthday. You know, and that's why you see a lot of people on the left now having these protests today, these No More Kings protests around the country, with the left, again, seemingly finding its voice a little bit similar to Trump's first term.
That's NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thanks so much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Even with the Chicago White Sox floundering in last place, tens of thousands of Chicagoans are still headed to Wright Field today for a special pregame celebration. That's because Pope Leo XIV is a Sox fan. Cardinal Blaise Cupich, the Archbishop of Chicago, has also planned a special mass at the ballpark, including a virtual visit from the Pontiff. Later today on All Things Considered, a conversation with Cardinal Cupich. You can catch that live on the radio or tell your smart speaker to play your local station by name. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. In two shootings in Minnesota, officials now say State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband have been fatally shot in what's described as a politically motivated shooting. State Senator John Hoffman and his wife were also shot. They have survived. The Israeli military continues strikes on Iran following overnight explosions at Tehran's airport. Iranian media say there have also been more attacks on the city of Tabriz. Iran's air defense system has been one of Israel's main targets. A federal appeals court voted 8-2 not to reconsider its ruling to uphold a $5 million civil judgment against Donald Trump in the case of advice columnist E. Jean Carroll. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Debbie Elliott. International students, asylum seekers, immigrants showing up to court. Under President Trump, more and more kinds of people are being targeted for removal from the United States. At the same time, the administration is limiting who is allowed in, as with a recent travel ban for 12 countries. NPR's Sandhya Dirks reports on how Trump's policies are telegraphing a massive shift in who is welcome in America.
Lokdar Ji is 29 now, but when he came to the U.S. in 2011, he was a teenage refugee fleeing forced expulsion from Bhutan. His family arrived in small-town Idaho and began a new life.
What I thought was being American was, you know, you come here, you work hard, you get a job, you follow the constitutions, and it doesn't matter what you look like.
He embraced the American dream, even becoming, like so many of his Twin Falls, Idaho neighbors, a Mormon. And he made his way to an Ivy League school. Now, he says, he feels like the Trump administration is redrawing the image of what a good immigrant looks like. And he feels like he no longer fits.
It feels like I'm doing wrong. You know, I'm not American enough, right?
So who does fit in now? We reached out to the White House to ask who they want to come, to visit, to study, to stay. White House spokeswoman Abigail Jackson emailed, quote, "President Trump's top priority is the safety and prosperity of the American people. He has always encouraged legal immigration by individuals who love America and want to come here the right way." The fact remains that the government has indefinitely paused all refugee admissions, even for those who followed the rules and completed years-long background checks. One group Trump has embraced with special expedited refugee status, white South Africans.
Welcome to the United States of America.
That's Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau, one of two high-level Trump cabinet members, greeting the 59 Afrikaners at Dulles International Airport in Virginia in early May.
We respect the long tradition of your people.
It's unusual for such high-ranking officials to meet refugees, and it's worth paying attention to the language Landau uses to welcome the group.
When you have quality seeds, you can put them in foreign soil and they will blossom, they will bloom.
Stephen Miller, the architect of Trump's immigration plans, told journalists the Afrikaners' upcoming arrival was a really exciting news story.
What's happening in South Africa fits the textbook definition of why the refugee program was created. This is persecution based on a protected characteristic, in this case, race.
The South African government says these claims of persecution are false, but that hasn't stopped Trump from pushing a debunked conspiracy theory that white farmers have experienced genocide at the hands of black South Africans, a theory that comes from far-right corners of the internet. That kind of white identity politics is often present in Trump's rhetoric, like in 2023 at a New Hampshire rally.
They're poisoning the blood of our country. That's what they've done.
Or on the Hugh Hewitt podcast that same year.
We got a lot of bad genes in our country right now.
You have good genes, you know that, right?
Or in 2020 at a rally in Minnesota.
A lot of it's about the genes, isn't it? Don't you believe?
He went up, I believe, to Minnesota and told people, I believe in race horse theory, and you guys are the ones with the good genes up here. That's eugenics 101.
The history of eugenics and American politics is something Shannon Bo O'Brien studies as a professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
At the end of the day, a lot of this comes down to immigration. The stuff from the history is still here.
The stuff from the history. One example she gives, when the U.S. passed the 1924 Immigration Act, which excluded almost anyone who wasn't a white Northern European, that changed in 1965 when new laws opened America up. Now, O'Brien says, the ideas from a century ago have crept back in.
Now we're talking about self-deportation, and we're talking about trying to remove people, usually of color, from America.
Removing people worries Wendy Villa of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. She's especially concerned about Secretary of State Marco Rubio's proposal to restructure the State Department by July 1st. NPR has obtained a copy of the letter the State Department sent to Congress about the plan changes, which includes the creation of an Office of Remigration. That office would shift focus from welcoming refugees to removing people from the United States.
The gloves are entirely off.
Villa says the use of the word remigration is a red flag. She says remigration is a policy idea that was popularized by an Austrian former neo-Nazi named Martin Sellner, who started using the term in 2019. She says it's been embraced by far-right European politicians as a plan to remove non-white migrants and Muslims.
What it really is a deeply racist plan to keep white people separate from non-white people, and to make sure that so-called Western civilization remains strong.
NPR asked both the White House and the State Department for comment about plans for an Office of Remigration. None was given. In America, Villa says welcoming Afrikaners, white South Africans, and removing many non-white people sends a clear message. She says Trump is signaling just who he thinks an American should be. Sandhya Dirks, NPR News.
Now for a look at an idea that's apparently driving the overhaul of federal health agencies. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has upended medical research and public health. One of the theories he's written about dates back to ancient Greece. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein explains.
The miasma theory is one of the first ideas that civilization hatched to try to explain why people get sick.
Miasma goes back to that modern physician Hippocrates, okay, in his ancient text from about 300 years before Christ walked the earth.
Dr. Howard Markell is an emeritus professor of medical history from the University of Michigan.
He wrote in a book called Epidemics that epidemics came from some type of pollution of the atmosphere, of the air that we breathe, and hence we got terrible infectious diseases.
This idea that, in essence, bad air caused illness was later championed by many others, including Florence Nightingale, and led to some things that did help fight diseases, like cleaning up sewage. But then came the germ theory, one of humanity's biggest eureka moments. Scientists like Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch discovered it wasn't some mysterious stench in the air from rotting garbage that spread diseases. Instead, it was living microscopic entities. Melanie Kuechel is a medical historian at Virginia Tech.
They discovered what we know as germs, microbes, so bacteria and viruses and other microscopic materials were actually what caused illness and also explained the spread of illness from one person to another. So miasma theory is debunked, essentially.
And the discovery of germs led to breakthroughs like antibiotics and vaccines. But in a book Robert F. Kennedy Jr. published about 4 years ago, the health secretary harkens back to the miasma theory. As Kennedy sees it, the miasma theory, quote, emphasizes preventing disease by fortifying the immune system through nutrition and reducing exposures to environmental toxins and stresses, unquote. But experts say the problem is how Kennedy defines miasma theory. Nancy Toms is an historian of germ theory at Stony Brook University.
I will categorically say that miasma theory, as historians of medicine and science understand it, is not what he is saying it is, period.
But Kennedy's take may help explain some of his policies, especially about vaccines. Dr. Paul Offit is a vaccine expert at the University of Pennsylvania and a vocal critic of Kennedy.
The miasma theory is the notion that there are environmental poisons, not necessarily rotting organic matter. For him, those environmental poisons are electromagnetic radiation, pesticides, vaccines. Vaccines are, for him, a modern-day miasma.
And that's dangerous, according to Dr. Tina Tan. She heads the Infectious Disease Society of America.
Can, like, stress, air pollution, other things, can that make infections worse? Yes. But the cause of infections is a microorganism. It's the microorganisms that are making people sick.
And vaccines have clearly been shown to safely and effectively protect people against dangerous microorganisms. Some argue that Kennedy's ideas about miasma theory and germ theory aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. Greg Gervin is at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, a Washington think tank.
The real debate here is whether we can solve public health problems by developing treatments like vaccines, antibiotics, or other pharmaceuticals, or whether we will solve these problems by strengthening people's immune systems through healthier habits. Why can we not acknowledge that there is truth in both of those positions?
Kennedy's office did not respond to NPR's request for more information about his views about miasma and germ theories. Rob Stein, NPR News.
And now it's time for sports. We're in the thick of finals season. NBA Finals, the Thunder clap back. Stanley Cup Finals, an all-around thriller. Sports writer Howard Bryant joins us now to unpack it all. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning. How are you?
I am great. Enjoying these NBA Finals, right? The Oklahoma City Thunder beat the Indiana Pacers last night, 111-104. That brings the series to a tie. Game 5 will be Monday night in Oklahoma City. The Thunder had looked unstoppable in the regular season, but so far it's been pretty evenly matched in this final series, hasn't it?
Yes, Debbie, it has. And what's been crazy about it, it's a great series. It's a fantastic series. It's now a best 2 out of 3 series. And I think that what I found most interesting about this is the Thunder dominated the NBA this year. They weren't just good. They dominated the NBA. They won the most games. They had a margin of victory over 10 points, which is usually a sign that you're going to win the championship. No team in NBA history has dominated the regular season as much as they have in terms of just the statistics. Obviously, the Golden State Warriors won 73 games and didn't win a championship. But to be as good as they've been and to be up against it is really also a credit to the Indiana Pacers. And the Pacers were just a quarter away from taking a 3-1 lead. And then Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who is the MVP, showed it. 35 points last night, really did pick up that team. They were down by 10 points in the second half, and it really looked like Oklahoma City was going to have to pull off one of the great comebacks in order to get back into this series. But they did it last night, and now we're 2-2, and you got two more games that are going to take place in Oklahoma City, and I think that we may be looking at a classic 7-game series.
All right. Now, Game 5 of the Stanley Cup Finals is tonight in Canada. The Edmonton Oilers and the Florida Panthers are tied at 2 games apiece. This hockey series has been rather thrilling, too, with 3 of 4 games so far going into overtime. Howard, what are you looking for tonight?
I think what's been really fun about this playoff in both sports is that we always talk about the big cities, the Bostons, the New Yorks, the LAs, and the rest of them. And you've got Florida, Edmonton, Indiana, and Oklahoma City, and they have put on a fantastic show. And I think that we have to give a lot of credit to the fact that there's a lot of good teams out there, a lot of great sports, and it doesn't always have to be the A-list cities that get us going. And this series has been, it's great hockey. Not only is it great hockey because you've had 4 games and 3 of them have gone into overtime. You've also, it's a rematch, so these teams know each other really, really well. You've got a ridiculous style and contrast where Florida is this grinding, rough, tough team, but also talented. But Edmonton skates so well. So you just watch these two teams go at each other. And it's just so much fun. And the other piece of it that I really love is watching the superstars, seeing Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl on the big stage is what superstardom in sports is all about. They are the two best players in the game. And boy, a joy it is to watch. But you also have the defending champions, Florida, saying, not so fast. We're pretty good ourselves.
Well, enjoy watching tonight. Howard Bryant, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Picture the scene. You're strolling along the boardwalk when suddenly and out of nowhere, a seagull swoops in and steals your French fries or your hot dog bun. It's a summer menace many of us have experienced. But when it comes to the diet of a seagull, is there anything that turns their beaks up? That's where Gulls Eating Stuff comes in. A website where people can submit photos of whatever they find seagulls feasting on. It was created by Alice Risley, an animal ecologist at the University of Salford in the UK, who joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, very happy to be here.
Let's start with having you just explain to us why you study seagulls and what they're eating.
Yeah, sure. I really love talking about gulls. So I study gulls because I find them a sort of incredibly fascinating group of species. They're very smart. They're very adaptable. And they have changed their behavior and ecology a lot over the last sort of 30 years. So they have really adapted very well to urbanization, land use change, and they've started nesting and foraging more and more in cities and towns, not even just on the coast. They're kind of going inland as well, some of these more marine species. And one of the things that we kind of want to know is exactly what gulls are eating. And I know this kind of seems like a bit of a dumb question because they do eat everything. But actually, this isn't very helpful if you want to make conservation decisions, for example. So we decided to try and dig into this question of diet a bit more. And this Gulls Eating Stuff idea was created where people can submit photos of gulls eating stuff.
So Gulls Eating Stuff is a way for you to collect data and information, but I imagine it's just also kind of fun watching what the gulls steal. Do you have any favorite images so far?
It is really fun. I have seen a lot of photos of gulls eating stuff. Nothing really surprises me anymore, but there was a photo of a gull that had just hunted a mole, which, yeah, you know, those sort of cute little mammals that live underground and usually they pop their head up on a molehill, and a gull, I guess, had been hunting them and had sort of grabbed one. I also saw a photo of a gull that had learnt to steal milk from a mother seal. So it learned how to kind of suckle on this seal, and this sort of poor baby seal was kind of like lolling around next to it whilst this gull stole its milk. And yeah, lots of photos of gulls sort of doing very comedy things in terms of stealing food from people as well.
Seagulls have been facing population declines both in the US and the UK. Do you find that diet is a factor, or are there other reasons here?
It's a complicated issue. What we're finding in the UK is that a lot of the sort of more natural traditional gulls, or I call them trad gulls, that are kind of nesting in colonies on offshore islands in remote cliffs, these are really collapsing. So actually some of these colonies have collapsed to zero. Whilst on the other end of the spectrum, we're getting more and more gulls in towns that are doing very well and are increasing. This is actually making it quite hard to know exactly what is going on with their populations. I do think diet would be a massive thing. We actually don't know for sure. This is kind of why we're sort of starting this project to look more into diet. But I do imagine that, yeah, lack of resources in some of these natural landscapes is driving their declines.
That's Alice Risley, an animal ecologist at the University of Salford. Her website is Gulls Eating Stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
A teenager joins the Union Army to seek glory through the fine art of flag twirling.
His ego is wrapped all the way around this thing. In his head, he is the Mozart of spinning this flagpole around.
Arthur Dinard Dale on absurdity, American identity, and his Civil War satire, How to Dodge a Cannonball. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is calling it a politically motivated assassination. Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark were fatally shot at their home early this morning. In a separate shooting, State Senator John Hoffman and his wife were attacked. They remain hospitalized. A rare military parade will be held in Washington, D.C. tonight to celebrate the U.S. Army's 250th anniversary. Across the U.S. and in cities overseas, there are protests against the military show of force, coinciding with President Trump's 79th birthday. In hockey, the Edmonton Oilers play the Florida Panthers tonight for Game 5 of the Stanley Cup Final, their series tied 2-2. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at Subaru.com/care. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Debbie Elliott. The new movie Materialists is a romantic comedy with a lot on its mind. Dakota Johnson plays Lucy, a matchmaker in New York City at the top of her game.
My speech is that if the girl asks for a 6-foot-tall drink of water in his 40s with a salary over 500 grand and a good hairline, you deliver.
Soon, Lucy is caught between a wealthy, suave suitor and an ex who's a struggling actor. Celine Song, who wrote and directed the movie, is no stranger to the world of matchmaking. Back before she made it big as a playwright and filmmaker, she worked for a matchmaking service in New York. I asked her what she learned in that job.
First of all, I think I learned more about just people and what everyone's deep desires are in those 6 months. What I learned so much about dating is that we don't seem to have a language for love that actually fits into the way that we talk about everything else. So we're using language that is so algorithmic or like something that has so much to do with math and numbers as a way to describe a partner for life.
Like 6'5", a credit score.
Yes, exactly. Like height, weight, income, age. These are numbers that are meant to quantify what a human being is worth. Often I'm hearing so many of these numbers in place of what we're actually talking about, which is another human being.
In other words, we're looking at those numbers instead of actually looking at whether someone's soul speaks to yours.
Exactly. And I think that it's also like a conversation, I think, about the way that we objectify and commodify each other in the modern world, which of course is now faster and better than ever because we have so much of it in our phones. In the middle of all of this, it is so difficult to then talk about the very ancient feeling, which is the mystery of love. Why somebody feels one way about one person or the other, there's no way to solve that through an algorithm or any kind of formula. It just happens.
So when we meet Lucy, she is very clinical in her approach, right? At least for her clients. She's assessing them with those same figures that you're talking about. And then she becomes involved in this, let's call it a love triangle, right? How does her experience there challenge her thinking?
Well, I think that she believes she is an expert in dating, but she admits in the film that she's not an expert in love. And I think that as she is being challenged by this love triangle, I think she realizes that she just has to face something about herself. When you're judging others, when you're objectifying others, it ends up becoming a judgment of yourself. And it's really a journey for her about recognizing that she, just like her clients, is not merchandise, but that she's a person.
Yeah, that's a line from one of her clients, Sophie.
Yeah, and not only that, she's a person, and she's also deserving and worthy of love, which I think is something that all of us, I think that we have real trouble believing in.
Now, what did John, who's played by Chris Evans, and Harry, Pedro Pascal, offer her?
Well, I think that they're both offering a different way of living or different ways of valuing her. I think both of those guys value Lucy, but on different terms. And the thing about the way that they see Lucy and the way that they value Lucy are both seductive and meaningful in different ways. And it's not just a decision she's making between just two guys, but it's actually a decision she's making about her whole life. It's really a story about this woman's journey through her own heart.
Dating has really long been a market, right? Since even as your film, you know, illustrates, I think, since the beginning of time, right? Do you look back on, I don't know, classic rom-coms or Jane Austen novels and sort of see that storyline?
Yes, of course. I feel like I was thinking so much about Victorian romances and, of course, Jane Austen. Because, of course, the first line of Pride and Prejudice is, I think, kind of a guiding light for materialists because it's a very materialistic sentence, right? It's about how a man of means should be in want of a wife. And that's quite true about the way that the marriage market, dating market has existed forever. The thing that I think that has gotten much harder is that it used to be that this dating market or the marriage market used to be a local. It would be about the garden parties or a town. But then what you realize is, well, in 2025, the marriage market or the dating market is not on our phones, on social media, and of course, in all the dating apps. So now you're not just comparing yourself to the other marriageable ladies in your town. Now it's you're comparing yourself to billions of people globally who are all also placing themselves on the dating market.
And are they really placing themselves, the real themselves, right? Like,
there's not
this whole of how you portray your image, right?
Exactly. And I mean, think about that too, right? It's like, well, why would you wear the corsets?
The Botox today, corsets yesterday.
The Botox. That's exactly. Exactly. The corsets have now become Botox.
Celine Song, what drives you to write movies about romance?
Well, first of all, I think that it is a universal theme. But for me specifically, I think that being a modern person and being a like a working woman and all of these things, I think that all day I need to have a lot of answers. And I feel a lot of pressure around like having a lot of control over my own life and destiny and everything. So I think that what I'm so attracted to about the topics of love is that I think that I just am so moved by something that does not have an answer. And to know that there is this one human domain where it's not possible to have control, and it's always asking you to surrender. I think that that really makes me feel very obsessed with it.
Celine Song is the writer and director of Materialist, out now. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I love food, and I love watching people cook and eat on television.
Schwei, you want to start us off?
Oh, yeah.
Usually, I live vicariously through the judges on, say, Top Chef.
I made a scallion pancake hand pie with a Malay-style chicken curry inside and a curry buttermilk dressing.
But recently, my job took me to the foodie city of Charleston, South Carolina, the home of Chef Shuai Wong and his wife and business partner, Corey Wong.
Whoa! Hello, everybody!
Hi. Shuai competed on this season's Top Chef, and spoiler alert, he did really well, making it to the finale. While he didn't end up winning the grand prize, we don't care. We just care about good food.
This is King Barbecue. She's been open for about a year and a half.
The menu here is mouth-watering. Crab rangoon with buttermilk hush puppies. Chinese barbecue egg rolls with habanero duck sauce. Mushu chopped smoked pork. They call it Chinatown barbecue with a southern smoke.
Yeah, it is really just a restaurant for the community.
That's what we always wanted to open, was just a neighborhood joint.
The couple moved from New York City to Charleston 10 years ago. They had a food truck before opening their first restaurant, Jackrabbit Philly. It's named after their zodiac signs. And now, King Barbecue. Both places are in North Charleston, outside the touristy city center, so you have to go looking for them.
We're going to cook something from both restaurants today.
And the journey is worth it.
King, we're going to make a crispy smoked duck on top of noodles with just a little blanched bok choy. That's just kind of my fondest memory of growing up in New York, going down to Chinatown.
First up, the duck.
So we cure it, we smoke it, and then we just drop it in the fryer very lightly to get it super, super crispy. The smoking is more, you know, of an ode to Southern style barbecue.
Chef Wong says it's a fairly simple dish.
Wonton noodles is what you always want to use. They're very thin egg noodles.
But that doesn't mean it's easy to cook well.
If you talk to a legit Chinese person, they'll know when the noodles are literally 2-3 seconds overcooked.
When the duck is ready.
So nice and golden brown skin.
Ooh, I smell it. Wong chops it with a hefty meat cleaver.
Chinese barbecue is always chopped because it's always the way of the cleaver when you cut us through bones.
Next up, a dish from their first restaurant.
Jackrabbit is very much more playful and recipes inspired by my grandma and my mom. I'm making a chili tofu, which is kind of our take on the mapo tofu. That's the first dish that Corey and I shared on our first date. The dish showed up on the table and I immediately scooped it up and put it in my mouth, not thinking that it would be a million degrees. And I spat it right out onto my plate and everywhere.
Yeah, we're both like crying. First date and everything's so spicy and so hot, but you know, it was a great time.
As an homage to their relationship, this dish has always been on the menu.
Pasta's cooked.
Albeit in different iterations.
Just like the Italians do, a little bit of pasta water.
Today, Shuai says it's in the traditional Asian-Italian style of fancy hamburger helper.
Soft tofu, chili sauce, which is sweet, spicy, tangy. And then the pasta that we're using is lumachi, like a thick elbow. And then we top it off with a little mozzarella cheese. Yeah, so
but it's, mozzarella it's, cheese and tofu sounds a little weird to me.
It sounds funky, but I swear it's all somehow works.
And it did. No spitting here.
Stir that. I'll stir this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, get a little bit of bite of everything. The pork, the pasta, tofu. Make sure there's a little cheese on there too. It's probably very hot. Careful.
Mmm.
How is it?
Mmm. Super. Mmm.
Okay, eat up, guys.
You know, you talked about mother's recipes and grandmother's recipes. How big of an influence were those women in your style of cooking?
Oh, so big. I was raised by my grandma. Like most Asian households, your grandparents raised you while your parents worked. I immigrated to the States when I was 9 years old, so I don't remember every single thing, but I remember a lot about her cooking, at least. And I cook from nostalgia, so it's always flavor profiles or combinations that reminds me of my grandma or my mom.
So we've gotten a little bit of a sense of this, but I want to talk a little bit more just about how heritage affects what you cook.
Yeah.
You were born in Beijing, grew up in New York, yeah, but you had Japanese cooking training, and now you have the Low Country influence.
Yeah, like the Low Country influence came pretty naturally just because we live down south, you know. So yeah, you know, I grew up in Beijing at the end of sort of where they were still giving out rations. I think you got a piece of lard, a dozen eggs, I don't remember how much rice, and then you got some money to buy your own groceries as well. And my grandma had to feed my grandfather, my cousins, my uncle, my parents with like very minimum amount of food, trying to utilize small amount of ingredients and lesser cuts or whatever to make a great meal. That's what I feel like so connected with Southern food. The Gullah Geechee community, the slavery that's behind the South, they got into lesser parts or the parts that no one else wanted and made such amazing meals with it, right? That's where collard greens came from.
Ham hocks.
Ham hocks, the field peas, butter beans. It kind of really helped build that foundation of my cooking. But yeah, like when I came out of culinary school, I was cooking American style bistro or classic French, as any culinary student do. And I wasn't so sure of what I exactly wanted to cook. You know, when I was growing up in high school, I was partially very ashamed of being Chinese. My mom would pack me lunches, and it'd be very different. So it's not ham and cheese sandwiches, it's Chinese food. Well, just throwing it out before I get to school. And at some point I just realized I really just want to embrace myself and my culture and cook Chinese food. And
it's the most natural progression I've sort of ever witnessed, that, you know, the menu started one way and then suddenly he's just creating legit Chinese food. Originally we were doing like mac and cheese with that chili tofu sauce on it, and just felt so gimmicky and not us, and that the food that we loved and the food we missed was sort of legit Chinese barbecue.
And the best food is what is your story, right?
Absolutely.
Let's talk now a little bit about Top Chef. At one point, you tell them that you thought you had already peaked.
Well, prior to going to Top Chef, I felt very stuck as a chef. I felt that I wasn't learning anymore. Being in that competition mode and forcing yourself to be creative, learning all these new techniques from other chefs and recipes from other chefs, it kind of just rejuvenated my creativity and just came out of it with all these new ideas or just new attitude of like, oh yeah, like, here I am again.
Sour cabbage sauce smells just like mama's house. Little tiny baby ants, it's crispy. Let's make sure everyone get enough ants on here.
I feel pretty great about this dish. Whenever I feel like I cook out of memory and love, it always comes out pretty well, so I'm excited.
So are we gonna be adding ants to the menu?
Oh my goodness. It was honestly one of the best things I ever had. It was crunchy and it popped, and it just reminded me of like citric acid or like lemons. Such a wonderful zingy flavor. I was like, oh my, I have to use these.
It was kind of in a way like the best camp you could ever go to. Yeah. That you only had to think about food and talk about food. Yeah. It was amazing.
Top Chef summer camp.
Oh,
there you go.
That's the idea.
What do you think you're going to take from that now?
I think what Top Chef kind of did for me is that I realized, oh, I didn't peak. Chinese food has 500 years of history. I've explored very little of it. So, you know, there's this place in Lower East Side in New York where this old Chinese man has been making chow fun for the past 5 decades. And it's the best chow fun you can get in all of New York City. And he just only makes that, nothing else. I want to just focus on what we do now and just make it better every day.
That's Shuai and Corey Wong at King Barbecue in North Charleston, South Carolina. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Scott Simon is back next week. I'm Debbie Elliott.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.